Welcome to For the Love of Conversation, the podcast that grew out of 3 Minute Storyteller, where we believe conversations connect us and social change begins with the stories we tell. At 3 Minute Storyteller, we share digital stories, video snippets of intimate, messy, expansive conversations with a wildly eclectic bunch of artists, scientists, leaders of all stripes, all who are legendary change agents. Some you may know, and hopefully many you don't. This podcast is the opportunity to bring you into the full conversation. I'm Shannon Mannon, along with my husband Mike and our VW bus Scarlett, who we've outfitted into an awesome mobile storytelling unit. We invite you into the full conversation with us. We're so glad you're along for the ride. This week's storyteller, Zui Kwok, has one of the most extraordinary life stories imaginable. She's overcome devastating hardship as a Vietnamese refugee to create a world-class mindful leadership training program. One of the many things that impressed me with Zui is how she weds her artistic vision of what the world can be with critical thinking that questions the world as it is. She adds to that her irreverent wit and a healthy dose of moral courage, which we explored in this conversation. Learning about her creations, both the Calm Clarity Program, which is a social enterprise that helps people overcome adversity to develop a mindset for growth, leadership, and resilience, and her Collective Success Network that pairs executives with first-generation college students from low-income backgrounds for mentoring and guidance, fills me with hope about what's possible when we learn, as Zui teaches us, to tune in to our inner guidance.
I'd like to share why I built Calm Clarity and why I wrote the book Calm Clarity. The reason is because I wanted to send a message to everyone who's ever asked that question, why are we here? Like, is this all there is? And they look around the world and what we see are people making ends meet, you know, children go to school, having to then get jobs, work hard, pay the bills, and then the next generation starts the cycle over and over again, right? Is that all we're here to do? Or is there something more than that? And I want people to know that actually what we're being called to do is to be the highest expression of who we are, to look at all those life scripts that we've inherited and question them and adopt them for our time. Right? Maybe the ones that our parents have don't fit us. Maybe we need to create new scripts for our generation, for every generation. What really makes sense for us? What brings out the best in us? And what doesn't? What holds us back? What limits us? It's time to challenge all of these self-limiting beliefs in our culture because they activate parts of our brain that make us feel small. They activate what I call Brain 1.0, the part of the brain that it's all about self-preservation, all about protecting yourself, being in defensive mode, and it activates what we call an inner Godzilla, where, you know, when you get upset, all you want to do is like smash things or disappear. Or our cultural life scripts can activate what I call Brain 2.0, the reward system. It activates this inner teen wolf that makes us go out and chase rewards, chase carrots, things that we feel will give us happiness. Often those things look like social status. They look like luxury goods, prestige. You think that as long as you can get these things, you're gonna be happy. So you're driven to work hard, make a lot of money, buy a big house, buy a big car, and you think, oh, now I'm gonna make it. So you can call it the unhappy pursuit of happiness, because it never gets to where you really want to be. Genuine happiness comes from growing, nurturing, and strengthening what I call Brain 3.0, the part of the brain that allows you to feel self-mastery, to feel like you've got a say in what's going on in your life, that you're connected to your core values. And it's the part of the brain that when it's activated, you feel harmony, you feel centered, you feel grounded. You're not a leaf being blown out in the wind. The reason I know so much about Brain 1.0 and Brain 2.0 is because I lived it. When I was a baby, I went through so much trauma when my parents and I escaped from Vietnam. And as a baby, I nearly died on the boat journey because we ran out of water, we ran out of food. And then in the refugee camps, all these tropical diseases ravaged the camps and killed so many babies and elderly, and I nearly died several times. But somehow I pulled through. I was developmentally challenged. I was slow to learn how to crawl, to learn how to sit, learn how to walk. And I didn't talk until I was 5 or 6 years old. But somehow, you know, the hunger to learn about the world, when people finally taught me how to talk, I had English as a second language, speech therapy, and I was so hungry when I finally learned how to read. I read every book 2-3 times just to make sure I understood it. I had to read them with dictionaries, and somehow I went from being at the bottom of my class to the top, right? And then I was stuck on achievement. In Brain 2.0, I wanted to be the best in my high school. I was extremely competitive, and I ended up getting into Harvard College. And when I got to Harvard College, what I realized, unfortunately, was all these traumas that I had experienced and suppressed and never got treated for, never sought treatment for, they weren't going away. And when I realized how different I was socioeconomically from my classmates, the fact that, you know, my parents and I were so poor that my parents ran a takeout in a very violent neighborhood of Philadelphia, and I grew up watching gangs come in and beat up customers. We had a customer leave the store in middle school, and he was shot in the head. You know, and I realized my classmates didn't have to deal with this, right? And they had no idea about my background. If I shared my background, people looked at me in horror because they didn't know how to process it. In the meantime, I didn't know how to relate to my classmates because so many of them were affluent in ways I couldn't even imagine. And so I was so angry at how unfair the world was that here I was at Harvard being asked to compete with students whose parents came from, you know, the top echelons of society, and I had no resources. And I was being asked to keep up with them, and I just didn't know how to do that. And as my brain shut down with all these trauma symptoms, I began to dissociate. I had flashbacks and nightmares, and I couldn't sleep. I had panic attacks that became self-destructive. I hit rock bottom. I decided to go and get help. And luckily, the psychiatrist explained to me that all the traumas I had gone through as a child had impacted my brain development. And unfortunately, there was no cure, right? But he could help me manage the symptoms by prescribing antidepressants. It would take cycling through different drugs at different doses to find one that worked, and that I should have therapy in order to look at my patterns and try to understand how I might be creating the suffering in my life, basically. So when I went through this, I realized the drugs and therapy did help, but it wasn't enough. And when I graduated from Harvard, I would be without life health insurance again. And I needed to find a way to handle all these symptoms myself without relapsing once I got myself off the drugs and off the therapy, right? And so I gave myself a project. I went and taught myself neuroscience, tried to understand what was going on in my brain. And I did realize that all of these horrible ways in which I was dealing with stress by isolating myself, by letting my inner critic run my life, was creating much more negative spirals than needed to happen in my life. And so I began to what I call mind hacking, looking at how I could change my life so that I could foster healthier brain development. So I got more sleep, I ate healthier, I tried to eat tryptophan-rich foods, you know, I cut out junk food, I exercised regularly, I made all these changes to my social life, so I stopped withdrawing and isolating myself. I began to watch comedies instead of very depressing art films. You know, I changed my diet of what I fed my mind and the people I hung out with in order to activate neural circuits in my brain that just were rusty, that had never really been activated while I was growing up. The capacity for joy, for optimism, for socially connecting with people who are different than me, like all of that was pretty rusty because I never used it. And I made an active plan to develop these circuits. And by the time I graduated Harvard, thank God, like I was able to stabilize my brain and bring myself out of Brain 1.0.
When you started shifting into Brain 3.0, what
you know, it sounds so overwhelming to think about creating new neural pathways in our brain. What did you learn that surprised you and kept you motivated on that path? What did it feel like? And then what when you tasted it, how did that help your and support your journey?
Actually, I realized it wasn't that hard because the amount of energy you get from being in Brain 3.0 was worth it. Whenever I was in Brain 1.0 and I fed that angry inner Godzilla in me, I would spiral and feel like even less energy, right? You'd have a burst of anger and then huge amounts of depression when you couldn't even get out of bed. Like, you waste so much energy being angry or beating up on other people or beating up on yourself in your head, and it doesn't go out into the world in a productive way. When I was in Brain 2.0 and all I felt was anxiety about chasing carrots, you know, being competitive, getting what's my due, you know, and you know, you also waste so much energy because there's so much tension in your body, and you're stuck in tunnel vision thinking like all or nothing. If I don't get this prize, I don't get this carrot, like my life is horrible. I might as well die, right? That type of thinking. And I was like, wow, like, you also can't see a bigger picture. You're cut off from your innate joy. You might get the carrot, but you don't enjoy it, right? And then all of a sudden, it's like the next carrot. You live life in this constant state of anxiety and chase, right? You don't actually savor any moment of it. It's like you don't stop and smell the flowers. You're just this machine, right? And you know, when I read a bit about how Michael Phelps described his life, you know, like London Olympics and before, he was this like Olympic swimmer machine. You know, he just knew how to get gold medals, right? But then the rest of his life, he was so miserable.
I noticed you didn't, with your trauma and the pain and that you endured, you didn't squelch that away and deny it. You fully embraced it. And that it feels like that really helped you own your story. Can you talk about the integration of all the aspects of you to create that wholeness?
Sure. So I do have to be honest that it's a long journey to integrate so many pieces of myself that I was trying to escape from, right? For me, going to Harvard felt like it was an escape. It was like a rocket ship out of the ghetto, right? And I thought, oh my God, everything's gonna be perfect now. It wasn't. You know, once you get there and you realize it's just a new set of problems, a new set of issues, and so much harder to feel socially connected when everyone's type A and ambitious and self-centered, and there was really no sense of empathy or compassion. I felt it was such a sink or swim environment. You just had to get with the program. You had to get your act together, or pretend you had your act together. And so that was another type of self-rejection and self-abandonment. And then even though all these universities talk about diversity and inclusion, you know, just because you get there doesn't mean that they make you feel like you belong there. And so it was more like, okay, you're here now because we let you in. Now do your best to fit in and assimilate. And so there was always a sense that, like, it's better if people don't know about my background, if people don't know my story, because then they can't look down on me. And so, but it was only when I decided, like, I was done with the Brain 2.0 way of life. I was done with chasing carrots and wearing a mask and running this maze, right? That there has to be a way to break out of the maze. And by that point, I was in my early 30s. I was now, you know, running like investments for a private equity team in Vietnam, that I realized, I was like, you know, I have hoarded all the carrots you can have that I ever imagined. I've exceeded my expectations when I was a little girl growing up in this poor neighborhood in Philadelphia, but I am no happier than I was when I was a kid, right? I have way more money than I know how to spend. You know, I get to travel to exotic holiday destinations. It felt empty and hollow. And so I was like, there's gotta be something else. You know, back to my original statement that we have to be here for something more than this. What else is there? How do we find meaning? How do we find purpose? If pure achievement and success doesn't get us there, what gets us there? And so I didn't want to just abandon everything and become a monk or a nun, right? But there's gotta be a way to hack your life so that, you know, you do have that sense of meaning and purpose. And so that's when I decided to take a year off and travel to learn, you know, ancient techniques on how to do soul searching, because I needed to do soul searching. and all of this neuroscience research came out validating that meditation changed the brain in all these positive ways. So I was like, okay, there's science behind this, and I love learning about neuroscience, and I'm such a brain geek, so why don't I go experience this for myself at the source? And so I spent about a month in Dharamsala, in different retreat centers. I then went on the Buddhist pilgrimage trail, visit the sites where the Buddha lived, and ended up in Calcutta learning about yoga, right? Ancient yoga philosophies and some new age yoga philosophies. And what really hit me when I spent all that time meditating was that my brain was changing. And, you know, I had been such an anxious type A person, even though I had learned about how to hack my brain and spend more time in brain 3.0. I had not really gotten myself out of brain 2.0 because I thought I was supposed to make money, I was supposed to be successful, and then I could focus on the things that was meaningful. But then I realized, like, hey, I'm already in my mid-30s, how much longer am I going to do this for? Like, when am I going to pivot, right? And so, you know, when I took this time off to go to India, and I had no business card anymore, I had no job title, right? I couldn't say Zwe Investment Director, Zwe Management Consultant. It was just Zwe. Who is Zwe now without her job title, right? Without being a star performer, without being an overachiever, like, what else am I? And, you know, when I went deep inside myself to find answers, what I realized, I saw myself, you know, all the times that I was in brain 1.0 and how I made things worse by being angry, right? How I pushed people away and burned bridges and all to try to protect myself. But I could not see the other person as being human. Then I noticed that there were these moments of clarity and calmness, meaning and purpose, in which I was in brain 3.0, and this inner sage came out of me. Right, this inner voice that guided me, coached me to do the things that gave me meaning, to connect with people who I became lifelong friends with, to stand for something bigger than myself. And I was like, yeah, that, what happened to that Zwe? Like, why can't she come out more and more? Why does she only come out some of the time?
So what, you know, leaving your journey, coming back to the States, What moved you about to create Calm Clarity? How did that manifest?
Sure. When I first came back, it's not that I had a clear idea that what I had just experienced in Asia was what I was going to give to the world. I was still processing and digesting all of that. But then the school district of Philadelphia announced that there was a $300 million budget cap, and they would lay off all non-essential teaching staff. So vice principals, guidance counselors, nurses, cafeteria workers, anybody that wasn't a real cause of stress in a student's life that helped the student on, you know, issues outside of class were gone, right? So how were students supposed to figure out how to get into college without guidance counselors, right? And I thought, wow, like, it's so much harder for a student to come up now and get into college. It's so much harder for students to navigate the system without all these adults that could have served as mentors and coaches, right? How are they supposed to figure this out? And then I was like, you know, maybe that is the gift that I can offer the world, because I somehow navigated the system, and I, you know, the system was so broken, but I managed not to break. And so maybe that is the gift that we can share, because there's never going to be enough people to hold everyone's hands. There's never going to be enough resources in the system that all the students get what they deserve, right? But what if the students learn how to manage the path, how to navigate, how to deal with setbacks, how to have resilience, and so in the midst of all this adversity, they can be in Brain 3.0 and make wiser decisions. A lot of the challenge with growing up in inner city is a lot of the adults are in Brain 1.0 and Brain 2.0. So you just inherit the patterns of your parents, your community, your neighbors, your relatives, your school, and you just continue that pattern into the next generation. But what if we teach students how to break out of Brain 1.0 and Brain 2.0, how they can grow Brain 3.0? Maybe they can be the ones that break this pattern, right? And the beautiful thing is the brain is so plastic that if you introduce this to teenagers, right, and the teenage years is when Brain 2.0 typically takes over, right? You have the dopamine system grows, you're so sensitive to dopamine, you take a lot of silly risks, dangerous risk, right? And if they can start growing Brain 3.0 at this time, they may make smarter decisions and not get themselves into as much danger or harm, or not make decisions that may make the rest of their lives much more difficult, right? And so I decided to build what I call an essential life skills program. And the whole idea was to help the students develop all the different neural circuits of Brain 3.0 so they can make wiser decisions and effectively manage their lives. And the results were amazing, right? We had students whose father was incarcerated and he had so much anger, and the program helped him to channel the anger more positively so he wasn't at risk of dropping out anymore. We had students who were addicted to video games and kept procrastinating, and once they had learned these techniques, they came out of Brain 2.0 naturally and stopped being addicted. They could focus on homework, they could do other things without getting caught up in 20 hours of video games, right? We had students whose family lost their home. They were kind of homeless, like living on other people's couches. And he shared how normally he dealt with stress by, you know, escaping. And once he learned the Calm Clarity program, he was able to face the challenges in his life head on and prepare himself to go to college, mm-hmm. right? So every student had different heartbreaking stories of what they were dealing with. And then when they shared how Calm Clarity helped them, I was like, wow, you know, like I need to keep doing this. And so then the goal was to create the business model by now packaging what we had for professionals so that we could try this buy one, give one model, where when professionals come and do our Mindful Leadership Program, which is four modules of the Essential Life Skills Program over a weekend, they're actually funding us to invite first-generation college students from low-income families to also join the same retreats alongside with them, you know, and doing it together, sometimes as partners. And it's been a very powerful experience for both the students, the college scholars, and the professionals to understand how they get stuck in Brain 1.0 and Brain 2.0, and how can they can break those patterns and be in Brain 3.0, and realizing that this is a universal human phenomena. This is not just a wealthy people issue or an inner city issue. Like, all of us are breaking these patterns together.
Mm. Are there any, have you seen any stories that come out of those relationships of bringing those people to diverse segments who might otherwise not find each other in the world?
Sure. I mean, again, we create a safe space in the retreat, and sometimes people are traveling, so they don't always stay in touch afterwards. But during the retreat, it has been powerful. We had a pretty high-ranking person at one of the big four come, and he was matched up with a student who came out of the foster care system, a student from CCP. He was now exploring entrepreneurship and, you know, being financially independent. And when they were matched afterwards, the person from EY shared with me, it was such a powerful experience for him because he had forgotten what he was like at that age in his own youth. And his father had abandoned him when he was younger, and he had grown up without a dad, right? And talking to the young men helped him realize like how much he enjoyed mentoring and connecting with young men who were going through what he had to go through. And he cried, you know, sharing like how moving it was to have that experience and see this part of him being expressed, which, you know, in the corporate world, he didn't really get to bring his full story to that either. And so he felt the sense of healing and growth from being connected and partnered with this young person. It's pretty powerful.
You know, you even, the concept of you creating Calm Clarity, where you had to trust this sort of like higher wisdom coming through versus your more skeptical, analytical mind.
Yeah. One of the most rewarding and amazing parts of Calm Clarity, or that journey, well, it's been wonderful having a positive impact on so many people's lives. But the truth is, I'm the biggest beneficiary of the Calm Clarity program because I'm still a work in progress. And I can still see this inner Godzilla, you know, come roaring up and taking over my life at times. You know, this inner teen wolf still makes me want to chase rewards. And I still have FOMO, this fear of missing out, right? And when I see what all my classmates from Harvard and Wharton are up to, I'm like, whoa, you know, my life, you know, doesn't seem to be as developed as what they're doing. And of course, they feel the same way about me. This is this like perpetual grass is greener on the other side type of thing. But what I've loved about this whole process for myself is discovering who I am when I'm in Brain 3.0. Because I feel like there was so many parts of me that didn't get to come out when I was like slogging my way through the inner city and like climbing up the corporate ladder and trying to prove myself as a professional. You know, I was wearing this mask, and now I can take the mask off and really be Zwe Kwok. And I think I'm still discovering how awesome she is, right? Because I'm still working on embodying the highest expression of who I am. And I still don't know how far that goes, what my potential is. And I'm always surprised when, you know, the universe throws challenges at me and I'm like, oh my God, I can't do this. This is too hard. And somehow this thing within me, this force of spirit, helps me rise to the occasion again and again and again. And I'm like, whoa, I really think, didn't believe I could do that. But I look back and I'm like, I did it, I nailed it, I did it, right? And a lot of it isn't like just being an achiever and like being able to brag about my accomplishments. It's more that I created space for this other person to feel whole. Like I created space to move someone's heart and help them open it after having it closed and shut down for so long. Or I was able to reflect to people this beautiful higher self that they have that they didn't believe was there, you know, and show them this is what I see and this is what's waiting to come out of them, to be expressed by them, to be transmitted by them. And people go, wow, yes, I know that's in me. This inner sage, this thing is also in me too. It's not that I have to be dependent on her or him or society, you know, or buying a nice car to feel that, right? It's in me. I carry this around everywhere I go, but for some reason I just assumed it wasn't there, that I had to consume something or buy something or pretend to be something I'm not to get it. And when people realize that Brain 3.0 is just inside them, right? It's more about managing Brain 1.0 and Brain 2.0, learning how to calm these circuits down when they get overactivated so that the inner Godzilla and the inner Teen Wolf don't hijack us. When you can do that, then this inner sage naturally, you know, flowers, naturally comes out. So it's not sheer effort, because the more you try to push against the inner Godzilla, the inner Teen Wolf, there's this like, you know, backlash, right? It's about self-acceptance, self-compassion, being able to understand the trigger, to look at the triggers that are causing you to be angry or causing you to chase, and then look underneath these self-limiting patterns to what the beliefs are that are fueling the patterns. Why do people feel like they have to chase this? It's because they think they're not worthy or lovable if they don't have it. But then, like, what? Why did they originally feel unworthy or unlovable, right? Because they weren't validated, they weren't seen, they weren't heard, they weren't cherished in some way. And then we all created a story that in order to have love, you know, we have to fulfill this other person's desire. We have to pretend to be someone that we're not in order to be seen and validated and heard and appreciated, right? And so we all started this from a young age, no matter what your background. And how do we get back to our essence? And to accept that we're all wounded in some way, we're all scarred, but there's this part of us that was never broken or scarred that can always come out, right? And that can be shared and lift other people up. And so I feel like this journey of Calm Clarity has really promoted my own healing and integration. And I get out of bed each day not only to make a positive impact on other people, but to see more and more of my best self expressed and be like, I like her. You know, when I look in the mirror, I'm like, I like you. This is great. Like, I'm proud of who I am. And I can't say I was always that way, but on this journey, I have become that way more and more. And it's the best feeling.
You know, I think about your mind. You were born with this incredibly, you know, vast, strong mind, beautiful mind, and your critical thinking skills were really honed in your educational process, and you've really not accepted any system, whether it's religion or a guru, without deep examination or reflection. But what I get from you is a really moral courage to your reflecting and your questioning that's really magnificent. And it also feels like, you know, you've got this vast mind, that's, and you've grown this vast heart, and the marriage or the wedding of those two has created, you know, who we have right now in front of me. I really want to talk about what that means to you, if that language of moral courage resonates, because I feel like, you know, you're, so much of your power comes from your ability to just like ask really big questions and bigger and deeper questions and not accept anything at the surface. And I feel like those are things that are just so desperately needed in our world right now. So can you talk about what underlies that? What's the foundation that helps that grow? What's the anatomy of that, if that
sure.
resonates with you?
I mean, how to deconstruct moral courage?
Just a little question.
And it's hard to say because this will be very personal to me, and I can't say that this is what's going to be what drives moral courage with other people, right? And for me, I think it comes from just witnessing and experiencing so much suffering, like as a kid, knowing, I mean, my parents sacrificed so much to come to America. They gave up the entire world that they knew in Vietnam and the language that they knew, the culture that they knew, for the hope of a better life in the U.S. And they had no idea what they were getting into, that what they were really doing was trading one war zone for another. When we got resettled in the Logan area of Philadelphia, there were so many gangs. My father was nearly attacked so many times coming home from work that he stopped coming home from work and he began to crash at other people's houses. And you know, when they did manage to take over a takeout restaurant that they could afford, it was in a dangerous neighborhood, and gangs would come in and fight, and in just to work the store, like over time, my parents' hands would crack and bleed, and they were so calloused, and they just fought through so much anxiety and loneliness and fear in order to raise their family. And I had a grandmother, my father's mother, who was mentally ill and care for her. So there were so many hardships and so many sacrifices and compromises because we had so few resources in order to make ends meet and make sure everyone was safe. So my parents' number one priority was survival, keeping us safe. They didn't care if we were happy. They didn't care if we were grateful. They didn't care about anything else. We had shelter, we had food, we had water, we were growing, like we weren't sick, done, right? Like that was my childhood. And they put me to work. When I was 8 years old, they said, you're old enough to help us. If you don't help us, no one else will. With grandmother being the way that she is and all these other issues, like we don't feel safe hiring anybody, right? And so I began working the takeout, you know, cooking food, taking orders, helping them manage things when I was 8 years old. And what was heartbreaking was watching customers come into the store who were addicts. You know, young mothers with children tried to trade their food stamps, you know, to buy cigarettes. And I would turn them down and say, no, we don't do that. People would come in and try to bargain and cheat us and do all this stuff because they wanted to use the money for other reasons, right? They didn't want to pay for their food. And when people got angry, right, like you would see this inner Godzilla come out of people when we stood up for ourselves and we didn't want to be cheated. People pretended they gave us $20 bills, but they only gave us like a $5 bill. And it's like, here's your $5 bill, you can have it back. You know, like, no, no, but they were trying to pull a fast one on us, right? And when you see like being cursed out, like hated, I remember when we first opened the takeout, the neighbors around us, many of them were wonderful and loving and embracing, but there were quite a few people who kept calling us to tell us they were gonna kill us, that they hated us, they cursed us out in so many different ways. And it didn't care, it was a little girl who picked up the phone, right? All this hatred was unleashed at me. And so, you know, when you're in the situation where you're hated for no reason, right, because people are afraid of you or they've been oppressed and they've been victims of trauma and they get some weird high from like, you know, bullying someone else who's lower on the totem pole, you're just like, you know what, I don't want to be part of this. Like, I have two choices. I could hate them back or I could just feel compassion for what they're going through and realize if I was in their situation, I might do the same thing, right? Because you know, I was watching my cousins become abusive. My brother was becoming abusive, right? Like, and I had the potential to become abusive towards my younger siblings. And I was like, you know, I'm seeing this part of me come out, and I don't like it. And you know, because we're treated in such a racist way, a lot of people become racist back. And I was like, I don't want to categorize everyone this way, because I can see there are neighbors who are wonderful towards us and a few people who are horrible towards us. But for the most part, people treat us with dignity and respect. So, you know, I'm not gonna carry on the system, right? And that's what moral courage is to say, hey, I have felt what this feels like and it sucks, and I'm not gonna do that to another person. And if I see this happening and there's something I can do to stop it, I'm going to stop it, right? I'm going to take action. I'm not going to stand by and say and be quiet just because everyone else is ignoring this, right? And so with moral courage and with advocacy, a lot of it is this willingness to be vulnerable about our pain and suffering. Here's what it felt like when someone did that to me. I'm sure you felt that way at some point when someone did something similar to you. Why do we do this to each other when I know you're a good human being and I'm a good human being? We do it when we're afraid. We do it when we're in Bring 1.0. How can we bring each other into Bring 3.0 and forgive each other for what we've done in Bring 1.0, right? But know that there's inside of us Bring 3.0, there's this inner sage. And if I'm willing to let go and forgive everything anyone has done to me in inner Godzilla mode, it can help that person move into Bring 3.0. And in order to do that, I have to recognize how much hurt and pain I have transmitted to other people when I was in Bring 1.0, right? This is universal.
You write about your the evolution of humanity that really unites science with wisdom and embracing all that we're learning, and you don't. It seems like your perspective does not see science and spirituality or religion as separate. It's they can really mutually enforce each other. And you wrote, I think very prophetically, when I tune in, I see that humanity is on the verge of entering a new age of enlightenment, arising from the convergence of mystical wisdom of the Eastern Enlightenment tradition and the scientific empiricism of the Western Enlightenment tradition. To gain inner freedom, we must also learn how to tune into our inner wisdom and direct scientific knowledge and technology towards greater spiritual evolution. So I just wanted to know more about what does that mean to you, and where do you see this taking us?
Sure. I think Einstein was the first person who said that spirituality and science can be two sides of one coin, right? Because they're both ways of trying to understand truth, understanding the mysteries of life and the cosmos. And you know, one is through intuition and one is through empirical analysis and data collection and experimentation, right? But they're both trying to understand what are the laws of nature, right? And as human beings, like what is the most optimal way for us to live and to be in harmony with the earth, live in harmony with each other. And so what I've loved, you know, is this flowering of positive psychology, behavior economics, when scientists have turned their lens onto human beings and understand what makes a good life, what allows us to flourish, and why do we do things that are so stupid and so irrational. Like let's be honest about this, right? Instead of pretending we're all, you know, rational economic machines, we're not. We often make the dumbest decisions ever, right? And how do we like nudge people towards making wiser decisions? And I think the beautiful thing is when we're connected to our inner wisdom, because there's so much science, there's so much technology, you can be overwhelmed with data, you can be overwhelmed with resources, you can be overwhelmed with what's out there, but when it's your inner sage that's guiding you to make these choices, right? You don't have to feel like, oh my God, like I'm screwing this up, or how am I supposed to make sense of these 50 options? There's your inner sage will help you see there's one option that really fits you right now. Maybe 2 days ago, another option would have fit you, but right now, this option makes the most sense for you. And if you unfold that, it leads you to expressing your higher self, right? Your energy lifts, your heart opens. You know, a lot of scientists do have mystical experiences. When Einstein describes what happened to him when he comes up with insight, it sounds like a mystical experience, right? Bohr, who first visualized the electron orbitals of an atom, it came to him in a dream, right? Descartes, who said, "I think, therefore I am," describes a visit, he had a vision by some sort of angelic being who helped him see that his mission was to bring more logic and clarity to the sciences, right? And so there's so many scientific figures who have these stories of somewhat mystical experiences that guide them to these great discoveries. And I think what we discount, right, is that there's much more to this universe than what the eyes can see. And if we're open to connecting to, you know, what the Eastern traditions call the higher self, the true self, or the Buddha nature, that we can tap into a much greater wisdom, this collective consciousness, and we can experience a sense of oneness. And when it's time to build initiatives, when it's time to collaborate, the best thing is when the higher selves of every person shows up in the room, and then the most creative, innovative ideas come forward, and the vision that we all have in common, that we share, we can all see how to manifest that and how our personal unique gifts, you know, can be contributed to make that happen. So that's the part that I'm really enjoying now, is creating these collaborative platforms where we're encouraging people to come in Brain 3.0. We're building a space, environment, culture where people's inner sages come shine forth.
It's a hunger and a longing for community, I think, as we evolve. I think a lot of times a spirituality or a journey of even just soul searching, or who am I and what's the meaning of my purpose in life, it feels very individualistic. And of course, that's like such a uniquely American kind of paradigm. But I think as we go, very quickly, we realize we can't do it without community. We can't do it without each other. And when through Calm Clarity, you're building these containers to bring people together, which is the powerful essence of it's what we're hungry for, because there's so few of those spaces where we can come and find that higher energy and that open heart.
Yeah.
And to find people who are seeking that same type of nurturing and nourishing.
Sure. What I found surprisingly is that everyone is kind of seeking it. Even if they don't know that they're seeking it. And so when they see it, they go, "Wow, I've been looking for that." But this is the part we're still working on, because, of course, when there's a community of people who know about how to be in Brain 3.0, can support each other, it stabilizes this, because otherwise these emotional states of the brain are so contagious. And if you haven't cultivated Brain 3.0 so it becomes your natural state, then, you know, most of the time Brain 1.0 and Brain 2.0 will just hijack you, because those circuits are way stronger. And when you're in groups where Brain 1.0, Brain 2.0 is the operating system that everyone lives in, you get carried back into it. And someone who's strongly in Brain 2.0 sweeps me into it with them, or someone who's strongly in Brain 1.0 sweeps me into it with them. But I have been very disciplined about doing meditations, practicing yoga, following my manifesto that I wrote out about the different dimensions of Brain 3.0. One of the strongest practices I find is the compassion meditation, in which I'm wishing, like, really positive wishes for myself, the people around me, and throughout the entire world. It basically starts with people saying for themselves, "May I be happy, may I be healthy, may I be safe, may I be peaceful, may I be prosperous, may I live in harmony with others." And you say that for people around you, people you're about to meet, you say that for everyone you're about to interact with in the day. And if you can say it with sincere intention and emotion and really feel it, that these are sincere wishes for yourself and other people, it generates these changes, biochemical changes. When you're already priming yourself to be compassionate, you don't get locked into Brain 1.0 as easily.
You know, to close, I loved your story that you shared a few minutes ago about the executive and the college student. And I want to talk about You know, it's around this idea of community. You know, with your collective success network and the generational interplay that you felt like was so important to create for the sake of these students. You know, you came, this was you. You were a first generation refugee immigrant college student who was dropped down in Mars with no support. And I'm thinking about change theory, how we really make change and what the value is in, you know, you had this experience at Harvard, you've created Calm Clarity, but yet there you really felt like we had to create a network. We had to create a surrounding community of role models and mentors for these promising young, bright leaders who have really underprivileged backgrounds. So I want to talk about why is that support system so meaningful, what the vision is for what a really thriving mentoring system can look like, because I feel like you do it differently than a lot of mentor systems. Yeah. And a big part of what I think you do is you understand suffering so deeply, so you're able to transform it more effectively. And you really position the students as leaders and listen to them. So I kind of two or three questions in there. So
talk
about that how you will.
So the vision for the Collective Success Network is that there are so many low-income first-generation college students across this country, right? And we're starting in Philadelphia. These are students who have the hustle and the ability to get themselves to college. However, for some reason, lack of mentors, financial stress, all these other things, it's the group at the highest risk of dropping out. And even when they do graduate, you know, it's said like maybe 6 out of 10 could drop out of college without a degree, but with lots of debt. And the 4 out of 10 that are known to graduate, statistically, many remain underemployed. So if they work their way through college in a minimum wage job, they may still be at the minimum wage job after college, and that's because they didn't understand that it's not just about grades. You have to like get internships and get through the door to transition into a professional career, because companies are not just throwing themselves at hiring college students, right? The college student, like the college degree, you know, is one of the minimum requirements, right? But you also have to have social capital and open doors and network and figure out like who's hiring and who can put in a good word for you, right? Because that's how the job market works. And a lot of these students don't know that. I didn't know that, right? When I was at Harvard, I graduated with honors, but I was always 20 steps behind everyone else. And so fast forward to 2016, right, I had built up Calm Clarity, one of my articles, Poor and Traumatized at Harvard, where I finally come out of the closet and tell like about the pain and suffering I went through at Harvard, went viral. And I was like, wow, like 250,000 people are like clicking and reading this, right, and sharing it. And I had no idea it was going to make such an impact worldwide too. So many students who were first-gen college students were reaching out and saying, we're still struggling, we still have the same issues. And I was like, really? After all these years, this hasn't been solved yet? And I was like, that means, like, when I was going through it, I felt like I was all alone. And there were so many people who are first-gen college graduates, but there's just nothing connecting us so that we can help first-gen college students, right? And when I graduated, I went about my own career development, and there was no platform to help me help other first-gen college students either. So I was like, maybe that's what's missing, a way for people to pay it forward. And so I was like, well, you know, through Calm Clarity, I'm connecting to all these companies as a trainer, and so many people who we've run workshops for came up afterwards and said, I was a first-gen college student too, you know, once they heard my story. And then on the student side, we're doing a college scholar program, and many of our students wanted to be leaders and not just talk about things, but do something about it. We made a choice not to be elite, because so many programs are, you know, they just look for the cream of the crop and develop them. And I'm like, the problem is the students who are not picked, you know, who miss the window, like I kept missing the window at Harvard. How can we design a model where as soon as students learn about us, and they're ready to be supported, because sometimes they have five jobs and they're just not ready, right? But they're ready now to get the support they need. They can come in at any point. And then on the professional side, what we're doing is building the social capital and rallying more businesses and professionals to get involved with this model, with these types of guidelines, right? And to my pleasant surprise, there's so many awesome, generous people in the corporate world who want to get involved and want to help. And
do they see the value? I mean, you know, beyond it being altruistic,
yeah.
Do you see a hunger on the corporate side for a different perspective and what the value add that brings?
There's a business case,
yes,
that these leaders are pitching internally, right? And that's the beauty, is that everyone cares about diversity and inclusion, but no one knows how to do it. Right, there's trainings and this and that, but like some of it is just like check the boxes, right? And what we're talking about is this deeper level of nurturing, coaching, grooming, right? Respecting their story, destigmatizing the word first gen college student, the word low income, right? Like we should be able to be proud that we came from low income communities and we're the first generation of our family to go to college. But a lot of people don't feel that way. They feel like it's a source of shame, like I did. You know, if people at Harvard knew that my parents didn't go to college, would they exclude me? Would they not respect me, right? Versus like, damn, how did you do that? It was hard enough for us to do this with parents. The fact that you're here without parents, damn, respect, right? Right? So that's what I'm talking, like you can flip the story, but it depends on your level of confidence, right? And if you have this community where we're all like proud to be first gen, and like you see these role models, like executives at these companies who are coming in and said, I was a first gen college student and I climbed and climbed and climbed, it was hard and I picked myself up, I failed, but I kept picking myself up and I did it and here's where I ended up. Students be like, oh, she can do that, I can do it. He can do it, I can do it, right? Now we know it's not easy, but we've seen enough role models and we know that it's in us, right? We just can't give up on ourselves, right? Even if the world doesn't believe us, we have to believe in ourselves, right? And so that's the power of the Collective Success Network, is like respecting the whole story of a person, helping them own their story, advocating to destigmatize this so that people and companies value the traits that first-gen college students bring to the table, because students are way grittier, right? They're also more compassionate because they've seen way more suffering. They can be very loyal because they don't take for granted when people are nice to them, right? And the students are extremely hardworking, right? So they don't believe that they're entitled to things. Like they're eager to learn, and if you give them the opportunity and you sit down with them and you help them see your perspective on things, they're like, wow, I never knew that. Like they're very curious, right? And so, but companies have to be able to find them, to nurture them and groom them. So I feel like a lot of the companies are seeing this as a potential partnership opportunity for recruiting purposes, right? And so it's not just charity, but it's more like, hey, you know, we want gritty, hardworking people with good values. Right? How do we get access to this group?
To learn more about Zwei Kwok, how you can bring the Calm Clarity training program to your school or workplace, and the Collective Success Network and how you can support it, or to order her book, Calm Clarity, How to Use Science to Rewire Your Brain for Greater Wisdom, Fulfillment, and Joy, go to calmclarity.org. And please drop us a note on our website, 3MinuteStoryteller.com, to recommend a storyteller to us, or just to let us know what Zwei's words evoked for you. And while you're there, please subscribe to our email list and YouTube channel so you never miss a story from us. Also, be sure to follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at 3MinuteStoryteller. Thanks for listening. We're so glad you're along for the ride.